From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, in our Earth Week series, we'll examine how marginalized people in Milwaukee are impacted by climate change.
The extreme weather events that have been happening across the country impact all Americans, and the most vulnerable populations, those being people of color, and then also those who are low income and just don't have the resources to protect themselves.
Then we'll explore the wonders of warbler season in a new episode of Chirp Chat.
Warblers are incredible little creatures. Some people call them the jewels of spring because they are tiny and bright and vivid.
Plus, we'll look at whether cats should be allowed outdoors and how to manage their adventurous aspirations. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. We'll start today with our Earth Week series. WUWM is focusing on the disproportionate impact of climate change on communities of color. Milwaukee infrastructure systems are increasingly burdened by erratic weather, and communities of color are dealing with dated water infrastructure, like lead laterals, among other issues. Richard Diaz is a founding member of the Milwaukee Coalition to Emergency. He's also water infrastructure field manager with Blue Green Alliance, an organization that brings together labor unions and environmentalists to work towards an economy that's sustainable for both people and the planet. WUWM digital producer Graham Thomas is joined by Diaz to learn more about the relationship between environmental justice and infrastructure here in Milwaukee.
So, Richard, could you just give us an overview of how climate change is impacting communities of color here in Milwaukee?
Certainly. Well, the extreme weather events that have been happening across the country impact all Americans, and the most vulnerable populations, you know, those being people of color, and then also those who are low income and just don't have the resources to protect themselves are going to be those vulnerable pockets. And here in Milwaukee, we see as more snowfall comes in or more annual precipitation, be it snowfall or rain, those really hard hit pockets in Milwaukee, 53206, 53205, 53208, those are the communities where families don't have the resources to pick up and take off, right? If you are impacted by a flood or a water main leak or failure and water gets into your home, you know, and my median income is $15,000 per year, I'm not going to have, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 out of pocket to pay a contractor to come in and remediate. So in Milwaukee, we see climate change hit hardest a few months ago when I think it was on Frederick Avenue on the east side, when there was rain that turned to snow and there was a water main leak or failure. And there was about 2 feet of water that instantly turned to ice, and the cars parked out on the street were totaled. Right. So, you know, we are not financially equipped to handle the burden of extreme weather events or climate change. And as we see more annual precipitation, as we see the climate migration happen, as more communities from the coast move to Midwest cities and move to Great Lakes states, we'll see those vulnerable populations not being able to keep up.
I'd like to ask you about the lead crisis in Milwaukee. We'll get to the MPS lead crisis in a moment. Mm-hmm. But first, what can you tell me about the status of lead pipes and lead service line replacement in Milwaukee?
Certainly. Well, we are in a lot different boat than what we were when the lead service line replacement program began less than 10 years ago. Milwaukee has rapidly increased its pace of replacement from doing about 1,200 lead service lines in a single construction season in 2023 to 2024, jumping by about 1,000, which is just huge progress, right? And then we also see with the mayor of Milwaukee, Cavalier Johnson, and the Common Council working together to create the equity prioritization plan that goes into the most vulnerable census tracts in the city and eliminates any cost share that a ratepayer may have to pay to get their service line replaced. And, you know, proactively, not reactively, proactively opens up the ground and replaces the lead pipes. I think we are on an upward trend of where we can go with this. And when I think about the impact of the bipartisan infrastructure law, I think about cities like Milwaukee really being leaders in how those dollars have been accessed from the state and how those dollars have been spent with lead service line replacement projects.
Let's turn now to the lead crisis at MPS. So far this year, more than half a dozen Milwaukee schools have been temporarily closed by the Milwaukee Health Department for lead paint cleanup. Lead paint has, of course, been an issue in Milwaukee for decades. It was banned by the EPA in the 1970s. And so, Richard, could you tell us, how did we get here?
Yeah, great question, Graham. We got here because we are waiting for disaster to happen before we take action, right? It isn't until a child is poisoned that we act. Right. There's this term, children are the canary in the coal mine when it comes to lead poisoning. And it's so true. Right. And the CDC says that the children that have elevated lead levels that don't receive interventions are oftentimes the ones that grow up with antisocial behavior. And, you know, you see research about correlations between lead poisoning and violent crime. You know, per every 5 micrograms per deciliter, you become increasingly more likely to commit a act of violence at some point in your life. So during my time with the Coalition on Lead Emergency as a volunteer, we advocated for the blood lead level to trigger an investigation by our health department. We advocated for that level to be a lot lower. At that time, the health department would only crank out, you know, 100 lead poisoning cases per year at an action level of 20 micrograms per deciliter. And in 2021, we projected that had the level to conduct investigations gone down to, at that point, the CDC's definition of what would trigger an investigation, which was 5 micrograms per deciliter, that caseload would jump by about 1,500, you know. And back in 2021, when we did that advocacy, we found out that to fully abate a unit in a household was about $25,000. As the health department has conducted more investigations and abated more homes, we've seen over the past 4 years that with inflation and the cost of living going up, we've seen that price increase for just a home, right, to now close to $50,000 per unit. I can only imagine what the price tag is for schools.
I spoke recently with some folks from Lead Safe Schools, MKE, and many of them seem relatively satisfied with the Milwaukee Health Department's response to the crisis thus far, but they're disappointed with how Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson has responded. So the mayor's office recently made a statement to Spectrum News saying that, quote, any accusation that the city has dropped the ball in school maintenance is completely without merit, unquote. What do you make of the mayor's response to the lead crisis at MPS?
I think the mayor has his plate full with the amount of priorities to respond to. As Common Council President, you know, current Mayor Johnson was a very integral point of the Coalition on Lead Emergency's advocacy to lower the blood action level. But unfortunately, there aren't enough resources to thoroughly investigate every lead poisoning situation for a child at the CDC's recommended level. The city doesn't have money to respond to things like that, right? And I think the mayor is open to different ideas and has the opportunity to coalition build and work with groups like Lead Safe Schools, MKE, Coalition on Lead Emergency, and other advocates out there that hope to get this done. But not only do we not have enough resources, we also don't have the right procurement and contracting space to get skilled and licensed contractors into these schools, into these homes to perform abatement, right? To be certified to conduct a lead abatement project, you got to go through a week of training, right? 2 weeks of training, which, you know, there is some good stuff in those trainings, but there's nothing about how to work in the construction field long term. There's nothing certifying you necessarily to utilize certain tools to be able to conduct an abatement job. So I think that non-union contractors that work in the housing space are really bad for workers. Before the pandemic, the Social Development Commission found that on average, contractors were paying workers about $12 an hour. You know, I'd argue none of the contractors performing lead abatement work at a large scale are signatory to any union and are literally just taking people off the street to make this happen. So that's not good for our city. That's not good for the homes or the schools that may be remodeled. You know, this low bar for contracting in the lead abatement space is really going to cost the city more money.
I know sometimes there is at least an alleged tension between policies that are good for labor and good for the environment and good for people of color, sort of a siloing off of these three different domains. How do environmental, racial, and economic justice come together in Blue-Green Alliance's work?
Yeah, well, that's what we do. We released a paper a few years back called the Solidarity for Racial Action, which basically lays out, like, you know, how we protect the built environment, how we respond to climate change and extreme weather events, and how we prioritize communities that are hit harder, that are oftentimes the Black, Indigenous, Brown, and other people of color groups. You know, it is a tightrope to walk, being blue and being green, and there are a lot of areas where we don't agree, but BGA is built on a consensus model where we find the things we agree on and work on those things, in which lead service line replacement is one of those that really speak to the epitome of what we stand for.
Richard Diaz, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Richard Diaz is a founding member of the Milwaukee Coalition to Emergency and Water Infrastructure Field Manager with Blue-Green Alliance. He spoke with WUWM digital producer Graham Thomas as a part of our Earth Week series. Later in the show, we'll look at the pros and cons of letting your pet cat roam the outdoors. But first, we've got a new episode of Chirp Chat, all about the Spring Traveler's Warblers. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Spring migration is in full swing, which means warbler season is upon us. These small songbirds are among the most celebrated by birders for their flashy colors and sweet songs. But most warblers only spend just a few weeks in Milwaukee. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez meets with Zoe Finney at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. She explains what makes warblers so special and where you can see them this spring.
For today's episode of Chirp Chat, we'll be talking all about warblers. And when I first started birding, I quickly learned that birders love warblers and are absolutely fascinated by them. Zoe, I know you're a huge fan of these birds as well. So I'm wondering, what makes warblers and this time of year particularly special?
Warblers are incredible little creatures. Some people call them the jewels of spring because they are tiny and bright and vivid, and they're just like magical little birds that instill this wonder for the birders who are hearing them and seeing them. I think they're extra special because they are generally like rare for us. So in April and May is the main time that we get to see warblers in Milwaukee. They're migrating through. Some of them are staying here, but for the most part, they spend a lot of the rest of their year in their wintering grounds, which are much further south. And so we just have like a short window that we get to like get out on the trails and get a glimpse of these beautiful little birds.
And you mentioned a few of the characteristics that make warblers a warbler, like their size and their color. And they also come through in the fall. Do warblers stay the same color year-round?
They do not stay the same color year-round. When they are migrating through in spring, they are generally in their breeding plumage. Specifically, the males have like a much brighter breeding plumage than, for instance, like juvenile birds and female birds. So throughout the year, they go through different molts. And in fall, it's actually like really tricky to identify. They're actually pretty hard to identify in spring as well. There are quite a few different species that come through, but many of them have similar characteristics. And so you have to like really learn the different field marks to be able to distinguish them from each other. And then when they lose their breeding plumages, it just gets really, really tough because a lot of them end up just kind of looking like these like dull, olivey, yellow-colored birds that you have to figure out all of their field marks to figure out, like, okay, am I looking at a black pole or am I looking at a bay-breasted?
Yeah, and I think that makes them just that much more interesting. So I'm curious, you mentioned earlier that warblers do make a song. Is there like a distinct song that they make?
So there are so many different species of warblers. I believe there are about 60 total that could be found in the U.S. Up here, we have around 40 that migrate through. And within those 40, they all have different songs. Some of them sound super sing-songy and warbly, like that's how they originally got their name. It's just completely varied on the species that you're listening to. Like some of them are so high-pitched that you can hardly hear them. And then you think of like a spring morning where there might be like dozens of birds that could be singing their songs around the same time. So even just like figuring out how to distinguish like what song am I hearing can be pretty tricky. And I think that's part of like why people love warblers, because there is this challenge with them, not only in like the identifying by song, but also identifying them by their characteristics. Because again, like it's a big group of birds, you know, there's just like a wide range of how these birds look.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that about 40 warbler species will fly through Milwaukee during spring migration. Where will warblers be traveling from?
Oh, they are traveling from all over. When I said that there are 40, there have been 40 total, according to eBird, ever spotted in Milwaukee. I think in like a typical spring migration, it's probably like more low to mid 30s is what you would expect to actually see. Here at Schlitz Audubon, we have observed 34 warblers total. But these warblers are neotropical migrants, and so that means that they are traveling from South America, Central America. Some of them stay in the Caribbean. One of my favorites, the Blackburnian warbler, flies as far south as Bolivia to then travel across the Gulf of Mexico and across like the U.S. to get up to their wintering grounds in northern Wisconsin and the boreal forests of Canada.
That's amazing. And so why are they traveling so far? Like what's driving or motivating their migration?
So migration is still something that even though it's been studied a ton, the exact specifics are still not 100% known. But what we do know is that these birds have an internal clock, an innate compass in them that lets them know it's time to go. There are theories that it could be the position of the sun that helps guide them, but lengthening day is one of the main things that helps let them know it's time to go, as well as warblers primarily eat insects. And so in the spring, our insects are starting to hatch, and so they're moving for the food sources. And so they're leaving their tropical lands to come up here to get more food and to breed in their habitats in mainly boreal forests.
And so when they're migrating through like the Milwaukee area, are they stopping to nest or is it just a rest stop for them?
It depends on the species. There are some species that this is their final destination, like the yellow warbler could nest in Milwaukee County. The common yellow throat is another one that we have nesting here. American red starts are another bird that it's pretty easy to find their nests around here. And they also like to be a little lower in the shrubs. So they're one of my favorites because you can actually get pretty good glimpses of them. But for the most part, a lot of these birds are coming through after thousands of miles of traveling, and they are using Milwaukee and other places mainly as a stopover. So when they see a green patch of land, they are coming down to refuel, take a little break, and then continue on their journey to their northern breeding grounds.
And so I understand that in general, bird populations are in a steep decline across North America. In 2019, a study was published in Science. It found that there are nearly 3 billion fewer birds in North America compared to 1970. And nearly 2.5 billion of those missing birds are from migratory species like warblers. So I'm wondering, what's contributing to the decline of warbler populations and what can be done to protect them?
Warblers are declining much like other species due to habitat loss, deforestation, and climate change, as well as just human impact on their wintering and breeding grounds. So one thing I think like the average person can do in your own backyard would be planting native plants and shrubs. Warblers, when they're coming through Milwaukee and other parts of the U.S., this is like a refueling stop for them mainly. And so if we have the right habitat that's like helping the correct insects flourish, we're just providing them a better stopover.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that April through middle of May is kind of the best time of year to check out some warbler species here in Milwaukee. Can you describe some of the types of warblers we often see fly through?
Yeah, I would say just a small tweak. It's really more like mid-April through the whole month of May that warblers are really here. They're starting to trickle in right now. Like currently in Milwaukee County, there have already been some palm warblers sighted, some yellow-rumped warblers, and pine warblers, which those are generally the first ones that come through. The yellow-rumped is kind of like a classic warbler. It's one of the first warblers that I would say birders learn, probably because there are so many of them, and also they are one of the first to come through. But they're a small to medium-sized warbler, and one of their distinguishing characteristics is they have this little yellow spot on their rump. And so birders like to call them butter butts, because it looks
so
like
cute.
A little pat of butter. And then when May 1st hits, it's kind of like gates are open. Like the floodgates are open, and from that point on, you never know what warbler species you're going to see on a day. It's just wild, like the varied amount of colors and patterns that these birds bring to our canopy. To be able to see that in Milwaukee, it's pretty incredible.
It's absolutely amazing. And hopefully that encourages people to like keep their eyes open, because they might never know what they can see.
I think that's one of the things that I try to explain to people. Like, if you're willing to take the time and patience to look for them, which can be tricky because they really love the tops of trees. And so a lot of times, like, warbler watching means that your neck is like totally up at the canopy and you might just get a glimpse of their underside, but that's worth it to even get that little glimpse.
That butter butt.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you were kind of alluding to it already, but what are some tips that you have for new birders trying to catch a glimpse of some warblers? You were saying like looking up a lot.
Yes. I think a few tips would be just be prepared to be patient. The flurry of activity can be overwhelming. Just try to like maybe focus on one tree and see what comes into sight. I would say don't get overwhelmed. Just soak in the beauty of the warbler's song. If you get to see a flash of that bright color, just try to soak that in and really enjoy that it's here. And I promise, like, the more time that you spend outside with your binoculars and with other birding groups, like, you are going to start to learn how to identify them. It's just one of those things that the more time you do it, you're going to figure it out. So, like, be gentle with yourself and don't expect to be able to go out on your first May day and be able to distinguish all of these birds, because even for expert birders, there are forums, there are Discords, there are Facebook groups that are set up specifically to help people figure out, like, what bird did I see? And so even the expert birders are not always going to be 100%. And so if you're beginning, you're not going to know right away either.
That's really reassuring. Thank you. Yeah. What are some other great spots that you recommend people check out to see warblers?
Yeah, Schlitz Audubon is a great spot for warblers. There might be different species in different areas of the property, but the tower is a wonderful spot because it does like get you more to their level. Lake Park is another really great spot for warblers. If I'm not here, then I will be in the ravines at Lake Park most spring mornings or like on the weekends. Grant Park is another really great spot for warblers. Being along the lake really gives us a lot of places that are prime for warblers because we're in the Mississippi Flyway and a lot of the birds are using the lake as their migration route. And so the green areas along the lake tend to be hot spots for warblers. Another spot, not in Milwaukee County, but Ozaukee, Lion's Den is another really great spot for warbler watching.
Yeah, I've definitely been meaning to check Lion's Den Gorge out. Yeah. So I will be doing that. Well, Zoe, we've reached the end of Chirp Chat. And at the end of Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month. So I'm curious, what bird would you like to highlight this month?
So because I already picked the Black Bernian Warbler last time I was on, I had to pick my second favorite warbler, which is the American Redstart. It is a small warbler that is basically completely black except for some really bright spots of orange on its wings and kind of on its like side breast area. They have a beautiful little song, very high pitched. I really like American Redstarts because they are one of the species, well, A, they're here most of the summer. So they are a species that will breed at Schlitz Audubon and other places in Milwaukee County. But also they tend to stay a little lower in the canopy, but they really do like to kind of zip in and out of shrubs. So it's kind of impossible all the same, but there's sometimes a better chance of getting a good glimpse of a red start.
Well, Zoe, thanks so much for speaking with me today and helping me learn more about how wonderful warblers are. This was really fun.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Zoe Finney is the creative lead at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center and a big fan of warblers. She spoke with Lake Effects expert Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat, which you can find as a podcast. And just like Chirp Chat, Lake Effect is also a podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen to us on demand. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we'll share some options for cat owners whose feline friends long for the great outdoors. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Cat owners know a lot of cats just want to be outside, but the outdoors isn't always safe for or from cats. In this month's Milwaukee Magazine, writer Ashley Abramson explores the dangers of letting your cat outdoors and what you can do to help manage that instinct. Abramson joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more.
If you've adopted a cat, you may have had to sign documents saying that you won't allow your cat outside. I know that I had to do that with my own cats, and it's something that's often discouraged. But when you spoke to experts on this topic, what was the general consensus? Let them out or keep them in?
Great question. So it's actually a simple yet complicated answer. Cats, like all animals, including pet cats, evolved to live in the wild. So they're actually hardwired to go bask in the trees and scavenge for food and stalk small birds and mice. However, as we know, our modern environment, I guess depending on where you live, is generally not safe for cats. So it can be extremely risky to let little mittens outside unsupervised. That's the consensus.
Now, do you know how common it is for people to allow their cats outside generally?
Relatively common, generally speaking, but the experts I spoke with said that outdoor cats are generally on the decline in the Milwaukee area. But, some owners still do let their cats outside, whether it's on occasion or, they live outside and come back for food.
Sure. I definitely have cats in my neighborhood who I know are pet cats. They come in and out of homes, but they do spend a lot of their time outside. And personally, as somebody who has a couple cats of their own, it does make me nervous. What are some of the dangers that await cats outdoors?
Great question, and there are many. So, I don't know if you know this, but the average indoor cat lives up to 18 years, but outdoor ones usually only live to 2 years of age, which is very concerning. That's from the Wisconsin Humane Society. I think traffic and predators are the biggest concerns. Getting hit by a car would be a big one. And then, in the Milwaukee area, being so close to the lake, there are coyotes. There are other animals that can harm cats. And even if, it's not a blatant attack, there are animals that can make cats sick, whether that's parasites or bites from other animals. They get into a fight and get rabies. And then there's the H5N1 bird flu concern that, the illness that transmits to mammals, including cats. So there are so many different risks that we need to be aware of when it comes to letting our kitties outside.
When I was a kid, I grew up in a much smaller town, but we did have indoor-outdoor cats. That's what we called them. But I think what happened with our cats is kind of what happens to everyone who has indoor-outdoor cats. One day, they just didn't come back. Now, they both were older, but is that generally the tale of having an indoor-outdoor?
That definitely can happen, whether the cat is injured or killed, or it's actually not illegal in the Milwaukee Metro for someone to capture a cat on their property and bring it to animal control. And only 2 to 3% of cats that are taken by animal control are ever reunited with their owners, which is a really sad statistic.
Yeah. I myself have actually caught, I believe it's five cats now on my property. We live on a fairly busy street and they get to this street. I think they've run out of their homes and they're going, "Oh gosh, this is more than I signed up for." And we've
It's a
been
lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. We've been very lucky to have been able to catch them, but I've unfortunately, also seeing the results when they don't get caught.
And not everyone is so kind-hearted. There are folks who don't want cats on their property and aren't looking to take care of this outdoor cat. So, who knows what would happen, and if they surrender them, you might not know where they end up, especially if they're not chipped.
Yeah. So I guess one of the questions that people might have is, are there downsides to keeping your cat indoors at all times?
That's another great question. Because cats did evolve to live in the wild and have that predatory instinct, they do need to be stimulated inside. And we see with cats, according to experts, that they might experience boredom or even mental health concerns, like depression can affect cats if they're not properly stimulated. And we've seen, as we know, that many kitties who are bored or, not doing so great mentally might exhibit behavioral problems like scratching your furniture or, peeing on the carpet. So there's definitely that need for cat owners to take the time to make sure their pets are stimulated like they would be outdoors.
How do you walk that line of stimulating your cats but ensuring that they're still safe?
Great question. So the experts all agreed that keeping any outdoor time as low risk as possible. So, whether that's training your cat to be on a leash, making sure that they're up to date on all vaccines, because even if you do have them on a leash, who knows what they'll get into or what other animals are around. And then, if you really want to be cautious, there are these, have you heard of catios? It's like a little screened box for your cat that you can either put outside as a standalone catio, or you can kind of build it into your window so they can see the birds and the other animals, the squirrels, get the fresh air and the vitamin D, but then without the risk of running into traffic or getting harmed by an animal. Folks can also bring the outside in. The experts said that cats really like to play with pine cones or even grass from the outdoors. We all know about catnip, and that's another great option to help keep them busy, munch on it, but also help them relax a little bit. So those are all great options.
All right. Well, Ashley, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
Black and orange stray cats sitting on a fence.
Ashley Abramson is a local writer whose piece on outdoor cats was featured in this month's Milwaukee magazine. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
I'm flat broke, but I don't care. I strut right by with my tail in the air. Stray cats strut.
Reduce, reuse, repair. Those three words are central to the mission of the MKE Outdoor Indoor Exchange Shop in Bayview. It specializes in making outdoor gear more affordable and accessible while prioritizing sustainability. They buy, sell, rent, and repair everything from hiking and biking equipment to camping and travel gear. It was founded by John Cameron, who was inspired by other gear exchanges he's seen out of state. Cameron sees his shop as a way to make a circular economy in Milwaukee and beyond. To learn more, I visited him at the shop.
When were you becoming more aware of the secondhand market, and, you know, what made you want to be a part of it yourself as a business owner?
I've always kind of tried to live off the bottom of the world. Like, I don't think that I need to consume much, and I think that I've lived pretty large as far as living off the bottom goes. So I've always kind of tried to live without consuming, and I see that that's growing culturally, so I'm trying to just kind of contribute to it. But I've been a reseller most of my adult life, probably just from, you know, not having much money from whatever job you're doing at the time.
Do you think the view and perspective of buying secondhand, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with thrift stores and that model, right? Mm-hmm. But what you have here is a little something different. Do you think in today's shopping market and changes of perspective that people are becoming more open and willing to participate?
I would say so. I'd say that there's still always going to be a cringe factor to used for whatever reason, you know, for whatever culture of people there are. But, you know, statistically, like, I think that there's a huge margin of people that are happy to, like, not consume, not pollute by using new products, and are tapped into the truth of it, and you know, and where their clothes really come from. So I think there's a lot of truths that people don't know that are the people that are also cringing at it. So.
Yeah, well, there's this concept and a term called embodied energy. Can you explain this and how it shapes your business?
Yeah, so everything I think about in life, I feel like kind of comes back to embodied energy. I think that, like, you know, it took this shirt, two boats, four factories, like 600 gallons of water, a bunch of pollution and dye out the backside of the factory. It took a cotton field to make it. It took, you know, synthetic fibers to weave it together. All those things and places and the origin of them add up to the embodied energy of the shirt that I'm wearing right now. So if we can alleviate all those processes by just using new or secondhand or repurposing things, those numbers are huge. They're giant.
So pivoting from an inspector in the corporate world to outdoor gear shop, what's your connection to the outdoors? Why did you want to focus on this for your first business venture?
So that's kind of funny, especially framed with the corporate interest first. When I was 15, I met some punk rockers that were riding trains, and I just wanted to be like them, so I did it. And I went to Key West on a one-way ticket, and I've slept in 48 out of the 50 states at least one or more nights. Doing that. So whether it was by thumb, by boot, or by rail, that's kind of how I got around our country.
So your experience hitchhiking around the country with, I'm sure, whatever gear you could find to now helping people with some proper gear, yeah?
I have definitely tested some gear, a lot of different gear, all the different cook stoves. I've had so many different sleeping pads. I've had failures. I've had, like, things that just lasted way too long that I'm ultimately impressed with. you know, yeah. So I don't share that all the time because it's not a focus of like outdoor hiking kind of health culture, but that is my experience. I slept on the ground a whole ton, a whole bunch.
So your model for this store, you buy, sell, consign, rent, and repair outdoor gear. So I want to break this down a little bit for any listeners who are unfamiliar, specifically about consignment. So I see some price tags around us, and they have certain dates with different pricing. So can you explain how consignment works?
Yeah, so with our system here, we do a 120-day period, and every 30 days, the item drops 10, 25, 50%. And then at the end of that period, it expires. So, you know, that gives it a good run at a few different price points. The focus is always used, but you're going to find a lot of newer tags that are used. So we reach out to brands directly. I'm not going to list them because we're on the radio right now, but directly with brands. And the brands have been really reaching back to my business model and appreciating what I do. And my thing right now on a whole like kind of vision is I'm cleaning up the gear industry. I'm cleaning up the perimeter of the gear industry. There's a lot of overflow. There's a lot of excess. There's a lot of overproduction. And I'm just reaching out and grabbing that overproduction, that stuff that's new with tags, that beautiful, crispy garment, and then bringing it to you at a reduced price. Then we can take it down to even the local vintage hunter that goes out and they go to the thrift store and they dig through everything and then they bring me in garments. And then there's people who just simply are cleaning out their house or are serious athletes and have closets full of stuff. It's endless, the resources.
So remind me when you first opened this business.
August 1st, 2022.
All right. So being in it a little bit, can you talk about your mindset when you first dove in with both feet, you know, changing careers, starting a business? Entrepreneurship is a scary and challenging thing. What was going through your head?
I am a cancer survivor and I could not do my old job. I could not physically do my old job. And then I also was no longer able to have my old job because I had cancer for too long, you know, termination through corporate, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I was crazy. I was absolutely crazy to do this, to start a retail store, and especially a cringy used consignment shop, you know, in a state that's never even had a gear exchange. So they don't even know what I'm doing. It's definitely a little fringe. And I just think that I had faith in people wanting to recycle. And I just think that I had faith it would work. And, you know, I'm still sitting on faith. I'm definitely not sitting on a mountain of cash. So like, I'm looking forward to, I feel the traction right now. I feel the growth. There's a lot of room to grow and there's a lot more products out there that I can continue to get.
Can you talk about some of the challenges or learning curves that stick out to you most? I'm sure there are plenty of examples, but does one story stick out in your brain?
Yeah, overbuying stuff that just doesn't fit. I've bought shopping carts of stuff that doesn't fit the store. And it's, you know what, it's good. Just donate it to the homeless and move on, you know, but that's a lot of money. And also I touched base with Amazon for a minute. That was a total disastrous mistake. That was kind of before I got the business. It raised the money for this business, but then it also took a lot of money out of this business when it crashed. And then, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes it's just hard with people, you know, dealing with the would or would not be people who would want to help you or work with you. And, you know, are their interests in line with yours? That's always a thing because this isn't like a job at the local Target. Like, you need to care if you're going to stick it out here. And so, like, it's good. Yeah, no, things are positive. I just think that, you know, like, it's hard to see what's in front of you until you're standing there 2 years later. And luckily, I'm still standing here. So
you mentioned you are a cancer survivor. And if you're okay with talking a little more about it, absolutely fine. If not, but going through that experience, and I'm sure all of the challenges and the scary moments of going through treatment and coming out the other side, you know, not that it essentially makes you more of a risk taker, but does it help you view things differently in taking chances on yourself and your shop?
I would have never done this. I would have never had the option to take this risk. This isn't going to get me rich in the first year, and I'm already 40 years old, you know. I spent my 401k on this, and that was brave in its own self. It was the only money I had, and it was like the only option. I couldn't work. I still, you know, I still haven't eaten this morning because I can't eat a half a stomach. It's just what it is. So I just kind of power through this stuff and get in what I can. And so this job's pretty much mandatory for me for a little while at least.
What kind of fulfillment does it give you, to have this space and to see your work come to fruition, but being your own boss, being able to work with what's best for you and your life and your needs?
it's really good. It's, you know, I really hope that my daughter and son get to see me be my own boss as they grow. But I've never been good at having a boss, and corporate, I was the square peg for sure. And so the best thing about working here, though, is like you get to come in here with your like goals and your like wants and needs. The thing you save all your money to go do, you're like, I'm going to the Grand Canyon tomorrow, or I'm going to Belize, or I'm going to Guam, or wherever you're going. You've worked really hard to get there. And I get to, like, basically listen to how excited you are, help you with a couple things that are going to help you along the way, high-five you, and then send you on that trip. And that is freaking cool because I get to see the best part of people. You're here to buy something special for, the like, one of the most memorable parts of your life, and that's fulfilling.
On that note, sometimes outdoor stores and the general culture of outdoorsiness, right, can feel exclusive or intimidating for some people who aren't familiar or diving in.
Absolutely.
And, you know, also just not financially intimidating or accessible, but culturally as well. And it can be a little unwelcoming to outsiders, or people might feel reticent to walk into a space they're not normally in. So how are you working to make this space welcoming and accessible?
The only people I make uncomfortable are the elitists. I try to make sure you know if you're a glamper, a camper, an RVer, a hiker, a hobo, I don't care. You're welcome here because, you know, there's only two places. There's outdoors and indoors. And if anyone wants to go and stake claim on it, you know, you can take their white flag and throw it in the river. That is not acceptable. You know, I think a large thing in society is people making up fake barriers to entry. And, there are no barriers to entry besides the front door of your house on the outdoor world. So, like, now let me step back. If you're going to go climbing and you don't know how to climb and you fall and you hurt someone, yo, that's kind of your fault. And there's a lot of things that do deserve a barrier to entry. So let me not be too light on that when it comes to the safety and well-being of our clients and our people out there in the wild doing wild stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, like, if you're not wearing a Patagonia jacket and someone wants to give you guff for not wearing a Patagonia or not wearing a Canadian Goose, that person's the problem. You are definitely not the problem. You're welcome to be here. And, you know, if they were in here acting like that, I would make sure that they feel that same kind of whatever they're doing to people. It's not comfortable. And, you know, it's not theirs to take away from you. So
I also noticed that you often promote other people, other companies, and bringing them in and collaborating. I first met you at the indoor-outdoor gala that you held. So is this part of your personal philosophy or role that you see for yourself as a business owner in the community?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I grew up on punk rock music, and I think one of the words that really stick out over time is unity. And that's a culture that, like, you know, don't die easy is unify people. And so the gala is a good example of, like, what my philosophy is. I invited everyone here for free, even my competitors. The whole point is to provide a better outdoor experience for the people. And so if we gather ourselves together as retailers and guides and everything, and we know each other by first name and we know each other by their family and our friends and our products, then we're going to be a lot better at referring each other and sharing. You know, like my friend just started a business called Forward Outdoor, and I'm really looking forward to watching him blow up because he has got the right mindset. And so supporting people like that, it's a pleasure and it's absolutely free. And, you know, we do a lot of clothing drives and stuff like that. We only talk about half of the stuff we're donating because we're not trying to milk it at all. But, like, it's strange to me when people don't give back because it's so easy. I'm running this thing on a shoestring budget. I got two kids. I don't sleep. And I still can throw you guys a block party for absolutely nothing.
I like that philosophy. You talked a bit about your biggest joys and takeaways from starting and running Milwaukee Outdoor Indoor Exchange. What are your hopes for the long run, or do you take it more short term?
No, I want to be old. I want to be in here with big ears and big old hair coming out of my ears, wearing overalls, all having the same kind of attitude. Like, I want my kids in here if they want to be here, and if not, you know, that's what it is. But I hope that this is my last job. You know, if we could blow this thing up and have 3-5 locations, I could eat for the rest of my life on 3-5 locations and everyone else would benefit. You know, we've already brought over last year $60,000 worth of consignment out of basements, attics, and you know, yards, so on. So, like, if we're generating that kind of revenue, that's 120 total if you know, count my half, out of the basements and yards. So, like, if we can do that on a constant, well, I think we're a solution to pollution as far as that kind of stuff goes.
Well, John, I want to thank you for welcoming me here today and for sharing your story. I truly appreciate it.
I'm flattered. Thank you so much for showing up and documenting our journey.
John Cameron is the owner of the MKE Outdoor Indoor Exchange in Bayview. We spoke at the shop last summer, and you can find pictures and more information at WUWM.com. There is also a free gear gala on May 3rd and 4th in the neighborhood right outside the shop in partnership with other outdoor voices, leaders, and retailers. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll share the story of one of the most destructive fires in Milwaukee history. And our next group chat features two Susans, Susan Kearns from Milwaukee Film and Susan Seidelman, the filmmaker behind Desperately Seeking Susan. We'll have a conversation with them about film, filmmaking, festivals, and more on tomorrow's show. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.